The number one rule is learn to hold the camera. It boils down to holding the camera in a horizontal manner.
As another video of police action goes viral, we bring you a handbook for bearing witness. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Also, a lesson in the possibilities and limits of learning to code.
There's always the idea that you'll be able to speak to the computer and it will do exactly what you want. And we never quite get there.
And Bob takes a trip into the future of storytelling.
I'm a bird. In order to get some altitude, I have to flap like an idiot. I'm soaring over Manhattan and headed for the MetLife building. This is nuts.
It was kinda. Stay tuned. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. With all the horror that accompanies the recent stream of videos of deadly police encounters, there is a bit of light. And that is that most of us who could not see or would not see what's going on are watching now. And that's making a difference. On Monday, a South Carolina police officer was indicted for the murder of Walter Scott.
Michael Slager was arrested in April for shooting and killing Walter Scott, an unarmed black man, after a routine traffic stop.
It was all caught on cell phone video.
On Tuesday, Texas police officer Eric Casebolt, who last weekend assaulted one teen and pointed his gun at others at a gated community pool, quit the force.
In a video that went viral, he was seen throwing a black teenage girl to the ground and pointing his gun at other black youths.
On Thursday, a Cleveland judge found probable cause to charge officers in the shooting death of a 12-year-old with a pellet gun.
Judge Ronald Adrian said in his 10-page ruling that the video in question is notorious and hard to watch. After viewing it several times, he said he's still thunderstruck by how quickly this event turned deadly.
Also Thursday, a grand jury indicted a Norwalk policeman in the death of a mentally ill man holding a knife in his doorway. There was no video, but one could reasonably argue that those other videos, all those gut-wrenching videos, may have made a difference there. I watched some videos Thursday. The pool party tape, a man hammered by police batons in Salinas on June 5th, Walter Scott gunned down on the run in April, a homeless man shot by L.A. police on Skid Row in March. Then I went back and I watched the death of Oscar Grant in San Francisco's Fruitvale station in 2009 and the beating of Rodney King in 1991. Even though I'd been reporting on these videos for years, I'd only watched snippets through splayed fingers. For this piece, I really had to look, because this is a breaking news consumer's handbook on how to make a video like that.
The number one rule is learn to hold the camera. It boils down to holding the camera in a horizontal manner. Just turn the phone sideways, because then you'll record video in landscape mode.
Journalist Carlos Miller founded the blog Photography is Not a Crime in 2007 to document his own trial for filming police while on assignment. Now it's a news site focusing on the right to record police misconduct nationwide.
Learn how to edit videos, because a lot of times people put videos up that are 15 minutes long and you're seeing the sky, sidewalk, trees. And then suddenly, maybe 13 minutes into the video, the main thing happens. So why didn't just delete this first 13 minutes if it's not really moving the story forward? The shorter the video, the more viral it will go.
More important, keep your cell phone charged. And most important,
keep your mouth shut. I say that because I've seen so many videos over the years where people are recording an incident of police abuse. And the person who's recording, they're outraged and they're angry.
Yo, that's your badge!
And what happens is their mouth is very close to the microphone. So when we're looking at this video, all we do is hear this person screaming and yelling, and we can't hear what's actually going on with the incident.
Ideally, a civilian recording a police officer should be a fly on the wall. Certainly present, but not particularly noticeable.
Seth Stoughton was a Tallahassee policeman for 5 years. Now he teaches at the University of South Carolina School of Law.
this is to the benefit not just of the officer who can handle the scene, do his job or her job the way they feel it needs to be done at the moment, but also to the benefit of the civilian who is doing the recording. The less intrusive they are, the better recording will be, and also the better their personal outcome will be. They are unlikely to be approached, accosted, or arrested by an officer.
Because officers have the right to tell you to back away if you obstruct them. They also have the right to eject you from private property, like a mall. You could even be arrested. Plus, a little distance improves the evidence. A prime example, says Stoughton, is that indicting video of the death of Walter Scott.
It was far enough away from the events that viewers could get some idea about what the entire scene looked like. They could tell that there was no crowd around, for example, no imminent threat to the public. A very close shot wouldn't have captured that information. It was close enough that we could hear the audio, not all of the audio. I would have loved to hear, for example, what the officers were talking about as they somewhat half-heartedly tended to Walter Scott as he lay on the ground after the shooting. But it captured the most relevant portions of the audio.
Something I should have established earlier. It is legal to film police interactions, is it not?
Yes. Every appellate court that I'm aware of at the state or federal level has indicated that there is a First Amendment right to film police interactions in public. So it is legal with some limits. There are certain activities that someone will not be able to film.
But interactions with the public?
A traffic stop, a pedestrian stop, a stop and frisk, those sort of normal interactions, yes, are subject to filming.
What do you say to a police officer who tells you to stop when you are legally and not obstructively filming their interactions?
It's a situation that I think calls for significant caution. I would urge people to be aware not just of their right to film, but also any relevant case law, that is the name of the case that allows them to film in their jurisdiction. For example, if I'm in Michigan, it's awfully nice if I can say, officer, I appreciate that and I will respect your authority and stay at a safe distance, but the case X versus Y gives me the right to film you in public.
I'm sure that's great advice. It also is really frustrating to hear that kind of thing because you shouldn't have to be able to cite case law to be able to do something that's protected by the First Amendment of the United States.
Jennifer Koenig is communications director for the New York Civil Liberties Union, which has developed an app that's now being used by affiliates nationally to safeguard civilian video.
It will film whatever you are pointing your phone toward, and then when you stop recording, the video goes directly to us. So that's kind of one of the cool things about it is it's impossible then for somebody or a police officer to take your phone and delete the video because it's already going to be with us. So you kind of have a backup.
So just by stopping it, or do you have to give it a shake?
Depends what you're using. If you have an Android phone, you just shake your phone and that stops it and it sends it to us. If you have an iPhone, you actually have to go in and hit the stop recording button. But the video, as soon as you stop recording, comes to us automatically.
She says she's received tens of thousands of submissions, none so far actionable, but that's not the point. The point is to open the eyes of people unfamiliar with policing in Black and Latino neighborhoods, to show that stop and frisk is not a polite encounter, that it may involve being manhandled, thrown against a wall.
It forces people to actually have to confront this idea that the people that are supposed to protect and serve us don't always do that.
The value of videotaping police is not just holding officers accountable for misconduct, although that is certainly important. It also gives us an opportunity to record officers doing a good job.
And Seth Stoughton cites that infamous video of that officer run amok at the Texas pool party.
About second 50, we see a police officer who's interacting with a group of young Black men very calmly. He is listening and engaged with them as they try and tell him who was or was not involved in an incident earlier. And he responds to their concerns by saying,
okay, guys, I appreciate it.
None of them were involved.
Okay, that's what I'm saying.
It's a very professional, positive interaction. having that on film is useful because it gives us a contrast to the actions of the other officer.
You know, as somebody who just follows this kind of thing in the media, I get the impression that no policeman ever wants to be filmed and will always object. Tell me I'm wrong.
I would like to. I can't think of too many people who do like being filmed when they're at work. There are certainly officers, though, who have recognized that they are not just representatives of their agency, but really representatives of the law, of government generally. I'm not saying that they should all be eager to be videotaped, but I don't think they should shy away from it or be defensive. If they want to inform people about what good policing is, then they should certainly be willing, if not embrace, the opportunity to do it on camera.
Hell, I wouldn't want to be filmed at work. Who would? But if you're a cop, increasingly it comes with the territory. And he's right about there being representatives of the law, because ultimately, that's where those lenses are fixed. On the cops, the courts, the judges, the whole justice system, they're all being filmed at work. Because the stakes are immeasurable. And the camera never blinks. You can find the ACLU apps and our breaking news consumer handbook, Bearing Witness Edition, on our website, onthemedia.org.
Coming up, a major federal agency was penetrated by hackers, and the media wasted no time guessing who done it.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, listeners. We're making a show about what we're calling the digital dark age that ponders what would happen if, due to cosmic forces or self-inflicted wounds, we were cut off from our personal history. We want to know if that's ever happened to you. Do you have a crucial floppy disk of love letters you can't read, a vital drive with photos you can't access, a video cassette of a wedding you can't play? What have you lost, and how did that feel? Record a message on the Voice Memo app on your smartphone and send it to otmwnyc@gmail.com. That's otmwnyc@gmail.com. Just make sure you tell us your first name and where you're calling from. Thank you.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On June 4th, the federal government confirmed that it had been hit by one of the largest security breaches in its history. The target was the Office of Personnel Management, and at least 4 million current and former federal employees are thought to have had their Social Security numbers and other personal information compromised. This is what we know. We have a pretty good idea that the hackers didn't get classified information. We have no idea exactly who did it or why. But there's been plenty of speculation.
Tonight, we've also learned that the prime suspect is not some nerd in a basement somewhere or a crime syndicate, but a superpower, the People's Republic of China, authorities say.
In the Washington Post this morning, the headline is China Compiling Americans' Data. The story says China is building a massive database of Americans' personal information.
Security experts tell us this is just the latest example of an ongoing cyber war with China.
An overwhelming consensus. Very possibly overwhelmingly incorrect, according to Robert Kanaki, a senior fellow for cyber policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Kanaki takes particular issue with the media's fixation on cyber war between the U.S. and China. He happened to co-author a book on the subject in 2010, but the cyber warfare he imagined looks nothing like hacked personnel files.
When I wrote that book with Richard Clark, the former cyber advisor to President Bush, we were worried about cyber attacks blowing up pipelines. We were worried about cyber attacks taking down critical infrastructure. That would be cyber war. What we're talking about is espionage, right? The second oldest profession, depending on how you count professions, right? This is spying. And spying is traditionally something that is very different from warfare. It can be a part of warfare, but it's not usually considered to be an act of war simply to spy.
We believe the attacks came from within China, but could be the government. It could be the People's Liberation Army. Could be a bunch of criminals in a storefront in Shanghai.
And I think it's safe to say that we know that this attack emanated from China, the country. What we don't yet know is whether we've traced this back to the Chinese government. If you look at what China has done to the United States in cyberspace over the last decade, all those cases are far worse than this. Things like stealing the information, the plans for the F-35, things like breaching the National Inventory of Dams database, the database that contains everything that you want to know about the dams in the United States. Those things have already happened. Why would the Chinese take the aggravation of raising another major cyber incident with the United States over information for figuring out whose email accounts do I want to compromise? And so we said, well, where else would this kind of information be useful? If indeed it really is restricted to social security numbers, dates of birth, personally identifiable information, that information is also really valuable to criminals. And so it's possible that China is, in fact, amassing this massive database on every American, the going hypothesis that the Washington Post has run with. But it's also possible that it might just be a criminal group.
You have observed that the assumptions following any major hack seem to be limited to history, that our imaginations can go no farther. Is that what happens?
Absolutely. There's a whole bunch of assumptions that are made every incident that it's always the worst possible outcome, and we lose sight of what we actually know and what we actually don't know, right? OPM is confident that they lost 4 million records.
That's the Office of Personnel Management.
Personnel Management, right? And they've listed out what they think they lost. The assumption that everybody has jumped to is this means that they lost all the clearance information, what you would really want if you were a foreign intelligence operative.
Because, aha, if someone has a high clearance, that means they're exposed to very sensitive information. And also, aha, they're more blackmailable if you know every single thing about them that was gathered during the course of their security clearance interviews.
And so that's where a lot of the hysteria around this incident has come from. We don't actually know that that clearance information was taken, right? So crazy idea here would be to wait and give the story a little bit of time. They've disclosed this breach so that the 4 million people who had the record stolen will know about that, and they're going to send out letters about that. If, in fact, the breach is worse than this, at that point, OPM will disclose that fact.
Robert, with all due respect, what you've just said is just stupid. There are cable hours to be produced. There are talking heads to be booked. There are speculations to be speculated. This will not wait for the information to eventually flow in. We have to guess right now.
So I think one of the things that we've seen is sort of the generic national security pundit jump into this space. People who don't actually have a lot of background or a lot of knowledge in cybersecurity, but it's starting to be kind of this hot issue. And so if you know something about China or you know something about Russia, you're also sort of posing yourself as a cyber expert and offering forth opinions on that subject. And a lot of the time, those opinions, when I hear them, I sort of say, wait, this isn't grounded at all. Or wait, you're going off of the latest thing that you just read on Twitter, and you have no way of knowing if that is in fact true.
With the endless numbers of security breaches emanating apparently from Russia and China and North Korea in the Sony hacking case, there is this sense of siege. But it's a two-way street.
Yes. One of the things that we know now because of the Snowden revelations is that the U.S. has a very active program. And so that's why I think when you look at an incident like this, you may not see that much outrage coming out of federal officials, coming out of the federal government, because it didn't necessarily cross a line that we've put down in the sand, right? So if you look at two incidents where the government has come out and officially attributed them, we've officially said, we know who did this and we're pissed about it. Those two recent incidents are, one, the North Korea hack against Sony, where we said, hey, you can't do this. You can't target an American company. You can't try and stifle freedom of speech. And the second time recently is the indictment of the five Chinese People's Liberation Army hackers over a multi-year campaign taking information from U.S. Steel and Westinghouse to benefit Chinese companies. And in that case, we not only said it was China, we said, here are the five people.
One of the reasons perhaps that we feel so under siege, if we are returning the favor to foreign countries, we wouldn't know because those foreign countries don't really report their breaches, do they?
There is no move afoot in China or Russia or many other countries around the world to require government agencies to disclose when they've been breached.
There's no FOIA in North Korea?
Exactly. The second piece of it, right, is that we do have this open media. And so even in cases where the government doesn't come out and say, we've been breached, there are reporters who are working to find that kind of information out every day.
One more thing. I'm concerned about what I've read about so far and what might happen in the future. I'm also a little nervous about what has happened that I don't know about, either because the government hasn't told me or because the government doesn't even know yet. Is that a paranoiac concern?
You're not giving the government enough credit on this one. There are thousands of people who are working to figure out what the unknown unknowns are. But in all of these cases, you need to remember that there's an overall context that you've got to be aware of. So in the case of China, it's not just about what's happening in cyberspace. It's about every other piece of the agenda, right? They may want to collect intelligence on us, but they want to do that without totally blowing up their relationship with the United States. They are just as dependent on us as we are on them for trade. Cyber is not something that happens in a vacuum. What happens in cyberspace does not necessarily stay in cyberspace. So calm down. Don't worry. There are a few common sense things that you should be doing to protect yourselves online. But ultimately, at the end of the day, when it comes to these nation-state threats, there's very little that you can do about it. It's not actually about you and takeover of your Facebook account.
Robert, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert Kanaki is Senior Fellow for Cyber Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can find a one-page printable version of our Breaking News Consumer's Handbook Data Breach Edition at onthemedia.org. Clip and save.
This week, thousands of software developers gathered in San Francisco for Apple's annual Worldwide Developers Conference. Apple delights in putting on a show for its legions of acolytes. And as usual, the company assured us that it's making the world a better place.
This developer conference continues to be the epicenter of change.
A bigger and better ecosystem with the elegance and simplicity that only Apple can do.
We don't mine your email, your photos, or your contacts in the cloud to learn things about you. We honestly just don't want to know.
The products made by Apple, Google, and Facebook in large part mediate our experience of the world, and yet most of us haven't a clue about how they actually work. The choices and sensibilities that shape their programs, the code that animates them. Does that matter? In fact, it does, says writer and programmer Paul Ford. This week, Bloomberg Businessweek is devoting an entire 72-page issue to his article called What is Code? He said that when Businessweek first suggested he do a piece about code, he wrote about 6,000 words and turned it in, assuming it would be substantially cut. But no, They wanted more, so he added another 6,000 words, and then another 16,000. It was now the length of a short novel. Finally,
I turned in this 38,000-word draft, and 50,000 is a short novel. And they called me, and they went, you know, we'll just do this as the whole issue. I went, and I hid under a blanket at that moment.
Well, I have to say that when confronting your story, I also had to fight the impulse to hide under a blanket because it's math. To me, it's math.
Right. And, you know, and it's totally fair. You know how when you read a book, especially like some old volume from 1910, and they'll just drop Latin in the middle.
Right.
And you're like, oh, no, not that. I don't know. And then you're kind of ashamed.
Yeah.
That is always the risk with this. But the point is, look, we are in a world in which trillions of dollars are being spent around these products, in which Apple is essentially a nation state. So I feel that people are somewhat beholden to understand the things that have power in their lives because that makes them more powerful.
You wrote in your piece, increasingly software isn't something separate from life, but something omnipresent, familiar, and invisible. It's in everything, not just a computer, but as you say, your watch, your camera, your air conditioner. So it helps combat magical thinking.
I mean, I'm just looking around this studio and we're surrounded by various kinds of computers, like the TV up there and the clock and so on. There are computers everywhere. And so, yes, you can assume that sort of elves are doing that. But the reality is giant corporate processes and various choices around programming languages are what are going into making this reality that we all share.
You wrote that code is a way to learn about the world.
That is true for me. I wanted to learn how to create my own magazine. And so I learned Quark Express, which was a desktop publishing program that was very kind of the standard in the 90s. It taught me how to track and kern and deal with typography. It taught me about how little I knew. You know, it taught me that I knew how to make a really ugly page, but not a good looking one. And that sent me to the library.
You said you learned a little bit about writing and editing from Microsoft Word.
I mean, Word has its own strong opinions about editing and crafting and track changes and where the font should go and how things should look. I don't know if those were the greatest lessons. I don't know if Clippy was the teacher I wanted. But at the same time, culture is embodied in these tools. The metaphors inside of software creep into our lives.
I'm convinced. I am ready to jump in. I've been thinking that On the Media's theme song maybe is due for a little freshening up, and you've got a program that may allow me to code a new one.
So there's a tool called Sonic Pi. We're going to learn how to make some bleeps and boops and do a little programming to see how we can repeat these bleeps and bloops and then try to make just a little tiny, I wouldn't even say a song, but a snippet. I'm not a very good musician. Are you a very good musician?
I like to sing. I can play guitar.
Oh, so this is exactly the opposite of what we're going to... Okay.
Let's go to my office.
Let's do it. Let's learn the code.
Okay. Here we go.
Okay. Let's see if I can make a
snap sound.
We made a snap. Now, we would really like it to repeat. So let me just... This is a white screen with, like, it says, 4 times do CT sample perk snap. I have a little tom-tom, a little percussive snap.
More cowbell.
I know, no, we can. I don't think it has cowbell.
No, I'm just kidding. Can you run it, like, 12 times?
Yeah, you want to?
Actually, it needs to be 16 times, otherwise we won't get, like, 4 measures.
All right. You see how we're saying 16 times? See that CT?
Yeah. Puts CT.
Puts CT. The puts means print. Watch over here. 0, 1, 2, 3,
oh, I see. It's
4.
Counting them.
We can tell the tom-tom which beat to play on.
Okay. Make it on the 4th, the 8th, the 12th, and the 16th.
There we go. So we're going to do... Oh, I broke something.
Thread death.
Isn't that sad? Thread death. I think I fixed my bug. Okay.
Okay, let's do another one with a slide. Can you add a slide? Mm-hmm. And then can we put it in a different place?
My goodness. I think we can. I'll do my very best. Actually,
I kind of like that.
That could be...
What are these miscellaneous sounds?
That's a good question. Burp. So we might just need to spend another month or two working on this. This is exactly the relationship between the media and the world of programming right now. We're living it. So do you want to record yourself?
I should say that obviously you couldn't tell from that whether or not I would be at all good at coding.
No, I disagree entirely. So I work with tons of clients, and there is a certain temperament. You sat there, you got into it, you wanted to know the rules in the system, and then you're like, let's put some music together. I mean, to bring it back to my article, that's what that's about. It's for the person who is code adjacent and just needs to understand what's going on in the world.
Let me ask a couple of quick business questions. Media organizations are rolling out these app-based content models. Is it fair to say that they pretty much have to think more like software companies now?
I mean, I think there truly is no choice. They have to build platforms and they have to be as good as they can at that because that's where the revenue is coming in.
So then let me ask you, how does the medium affect the message, the content? How does that change the kind of stuff that gets produced?
I think it changes in small ways at first. I think Vine is a great example. Vine is just video, but it also is 6 seconds long and it loops. And so there's this element of form that is different and it has encouraged a totally different kind of content and expression and also created a totally different kind of community. The structure of YouTube videos, especially ones where people are just sort of staring at the camera and talking, people pick up the norms. They teach each other as to what makes a good or a bad one of these.
But do you think that the culture of coding will ultimately affect the culture at large? You've written that software conferences increasingly deal with a climate of sexual harassment towards women, that the industry struggles to recruit female engineers, that actually there are fewer female engineers now than there were in the 80s.
I've talked to so many women who left the industry because they just didn't want to deal anymore. It's because they were bright and talented and they went, well, I don't have to be treated like this. The thing that is really dangerous about that to me is look at Apple and look at Facebook and look at the incredible cultural power they have. They are defining the forms that we use to communicate. Code itself is ultimately just going to run inside of the computer, right? But it changes how people communicate and it changes how people accept new ideas. Those ideas could be about how something looks. It could be about how something works. You know, just today or yesterday, I believe Apple announced that it was going to support menstruation in the health kit on its phones. So that
it's going to support it? Was it previously against it?
No. Yes. Yeah. It came out strong. No, they didn't get to that checkbox. Clearly somebody thought about it, right? Like I would just assume, but they're like, well, let's focus on jogging.
They just came out this week with a menstruation tracker?
To be honest, menstruation probably hasn't been a priority for Apple in its long history. And so that's a step forward that we acknowledge that women menstruate in our iPhone apps.
Do you think that if we really understood how much code serves as an invisible filter in our lives, we might be a little less willing to share our data?
Oh, I think so. The relationship that programmers have to the idea of, say, metadata from the NSA is very different than it might have been presented in the press.
That's phone numbers and durations of calls.
They know everyone you've called. They know where you were and so on and so forth. That's the metadata. To me, that's the more interesting stuff than the substance of the call, which is 90% of the time I'm going to 7-Eleven. All the other stuff is about the social relationships. Here's a great example of that. Facebook is a company built on metadata. I don't think they care too much about what you put in the box, but they care about who your friends are. They care about the things you like because they can sell ads based on that. It is a metadata-driven company. And knowing what that means will make you rethink some of the relationships you have with these giant entities.
Let me end with one more of your quotes. The industry is always promising to eat itself, to come up with a paradigm so perfect that we can all stop wasting our time and enter a world of pure digital thought. It never happens.
There's always the idea that they're going to make a programming language that is just super fast and super capable. You'll be able to speak to the computer and it will do exactly what you want. And we never quite get there. It's a Zeno's paradox kind of situation where we're like, oh, wow, this is great. Self-driving cars, but then we're going to have all these new issues that self-driving cars generate. As far as I can tell, there's going to be a very long-term need for developers and coders who can make the computer do things.
Well, we've had plumbing and electricity for a while. We still need plumbers and electricians.
That's exactly right.
Thank you so much.
It is great to be here.
Paul Borg wrote the latest edition of Business Week called What is Code?
Coming up, the never-ending story of storytelling.
This is On the Media. This is Brooke. When you've finished listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie about Pop-Tarts.
Did you really like Pop-Tarts all that much growing up?
Oh, yeah.
How about now?
Still, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I love them.
That's a good breakfast for you?
I eat it after a bad show on a Wednesday night.
Listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Conventional wisdom says that new media have ushered in a new kind of journalism. And the fact is, despite all the conferences and anxious op-eds, we really don't know where we're going. Veteran journalist, educator, and historian Lauren Giglione was tasked with writing about the future of journalism, and his search for answers pulled him in an unusual, though perhaps inevitable, direction. He immersed himself in a genre he'd always disdained. Science fiction, also known as speculative fiction. When we spoke to him a few years back, he had found that when authors imagine with reckless abandon, their predictive powers often outshine the experts.
I mean, this started for me when I was guest curator for a Library of Congress on the history of the American journalist. And the library said, the last chapter must be on the future. And I started reading futurists, and then I started reading science fiction writers. I decided that the science fiction writers probably were more worth reading than the futurists.
Because as you quote Ben Bova observing in your piece, futurists could not have predicted the transistor because there wasn't any science to underlie it back in the early days of the last century.
Right.
But speculative fiction writers, science fiction writers, did. They predicted miniaturization all over the place because they just assumed it was going to happen eventually.
Exactly.
So let's talk about how speculative fiction has treated the news media. French writers distinguished themselves early, beginning with Émile Souvestre in 1846.
Yes, well, they extrapolated from the newspapers of the day to have a newspaper that would be one large spool of newsprint with type on it running through a village and going up to the third floor apartment and down to the street, and people would read this moving roll of newspaper. But they also anticipated more dramatically news on television and interactivity.
We should stipulate this is fully 100 years before television.
Exactly right. And the illustrations in the novel show people looking at a screen in their homes.
Albert Robida wrote The 20th Century in 1887. What was his vision?
He's the one who had the all-electric home with telephonographics, news bulletins delivered automatically through telephones. And he had wall-sized telephonoscopes, which were televisions that were interactive, so people could react to the news and communicate with other people who were seeing the news.
What a bizarre idea. Now, if we get to the American mid-century, we inevitably trip over Clark Kent. Does he have anything to say about the future of the news business?
For reporters, you know, the ability to see through buildings and see somebody is lying, that anticipates a lot of science fiction, which focus on the eye, a super eye that can tell us much more than the human eye can tell us.
But, of course, Superman comes by his superness naturally. In the 1979 film Death Watch, starring Harry Dean Stanton and Harvey Keitel, journalists are modified.
Yes. Roddy the reporter, played by Harvey Keitel, has a miniature camera implanted in his head so that he can watch human death occur. And at that point, death is no longer occurring. So this is a major news event.
Whatever I see,
mysterious, terrifying. I just watch it, and it's on film forever.
And then there's another similar kind of story where Maya Andreeva, the News One telepresence camera in Raphael Carter's The Fortunate Fall.
In 1996.
Right. She can transmit to viewers a holographic memory of interviews. And so the event is vivid and complete as if it's happening right there.
But before implanted cameras and transplanted memories, there was the indelible Max Headroom, a computerized reporter in the days before computer technology was good enough to actually depict a computer reporter. So he was covered in foam and latex, and he wore a fiberglass suit.
Max Headroom here. Actually, I'm not here because I live 20 minutes into the future. You want to join me here?
Let's talk about another image that science fiction writers came up with regard to news, and that is journalist-free dystopias.
Yes.
Like those described by novelist William Gibson, who created the cyberpunk genre, starting with Neuromancer in 1984. That is a world where all your information comes by and through, essentially, hackers.
Yes, and I think there are many people who would say today, we are all journalists. So there's not a special class of professional that's necessary anymore. I don't believe it. The society depends on aggressive reporting. The world is extremely complicated. And so to get at the truth or a version of the truth requires real work.
Is there any prediction that struck you as more likely than another?
Well, I don't know what's more likely, but I am intrigued about moving beyond the handheld devices. I remember hearing somebody who invented the handheld device talking about implanting various devices in the human body that might take care of delivery of news and everything else. So who knows where all of this is headed?
As you quote Einstein, if at first an idea does not sound absurd, then there's no hope for it.
Yes, I love that. The future is likely to be counterfactual and not built on what has just happened.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lauren Giglioni teaches at the McGill School of Journalism. From cave drawings to Homer's Odyssey to Orphan Black, the one constant of every society in every age is storytelling. What isn't constant is the form, which changes with culture, with time, and especially with technology. Recently, Bob checked out a museum exhibit about the biggest change in storytelling since the moving image.
Hi, can I have your name?
Hi, Paul Hand.
This is your final notice. Move or be moved.
That is the sound of a six-sided movie on something called the Google Cube. It's from an exhibit at the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens, New York, an exhibit titled Sensory Stories, which reimagines storytelling in the digital age, and it certainly is a feast for the senses. There's Birdly, a magical virtual reality experience that allows you to soar over the streets of New York City.
Oh, flap? I'm a bird. In order to get some altitude, I have to flap like an idiot. I'm soaring over Manhattan and headed for the MetLife building. This is nuts.
There's an interactive movie called Possibilia, which lets the viewer dictate the trajectory of a lover's quarrel.
I can't do this.
What kind of messed up logic makes it okay for us to take a stroll and then we lay around? I can't do this!
Me neither. God,
and there's an installation called Darkroom Sex Game, which propels rhythmic synchrony using just sound and vibration until, well, just use your imagination.
So these are people tasting my spaghetti bolognese.
Yes.
The exhibit is the brainchild of Charlie Melcher, founder of the nonprofit called Future of Storytelling. He was a book packager who could see his ink-on-paper profession being gradually digital revolutionized out of existence, but was skeptical of technology's ability to satisfy the primal need for narrative. That is, until he published the app version of Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth and suddenly saw past analog.
I believe that it's just that we can't see the benefits of this digital age. We're just not imagining well enough right now all the great things that are going to come from this. And so I decided to switch from being somebody who was a little threatened by the changes taking place to getting totally on board and becoming an evangelist for them.
Sort of Billy Graham meets that guy from Geek Squad. Here's Melcher explaining that Google Cube, which projects a different scene from a movie depending on which face of the cube the viewer turns upright.
There are six threads to this story that all play simultaneously, each reflected on one of the faces of the cube. In that cube is a cell phone, and this uses the gyroscope of the cell phone to control through Bluetooth computer that's in that box that controls the projector.
That's not cool, man! Ow!
I feel like I'm in some futuristic movie made in 1976, imagining how we experience entertainment, right? That it's like Fahrenheit 451 or 1984 or Sleeper. I should be wearing some sort of white overalls and a funny helmet, should I not? Okay, maybe that was argumentative, but this wasn't my first rodeo. It wasn't even my first rodeo in Queens, where 51 years ago, I also got a peek into technology's vast promise.
Welcome to a journey into the future, a journey for everyone today into the everywhere of tomorrow.
That was from the 1964 World's Fair, where I glimpsed moon colonies, lasers felling trees through the rainforest, and the vast promise of the briny deep.
Now we can farm and harvest a drifting, swimming, never-ending nourishment, food enough to feed seven times the population of the Earth.
Sometimes the future seems so close at hand, you can almost taste it. Or at least, smell it. At the museum, I sampled the exhibit called Goldilocks and the Three Bears, the smelly version, which adds the long-absent olfactory dimension to children's literature. Really? Read and sniff? This is what we have to look forward to?
We have no idea what this is going to look like in 2020. I'm hoping, though, that these are just the beginnings of what's really coming. The future is here. It's just unevenly distributed.
Pretty good line. And no sooner had he uttered it than I put on a set of Oculus Rift goggles and took in the documentary titled Clouds Over Sidra, a virtual reality film narrated by a young Syrian girl in Jordan's Za'atari refugee camp.
My name is Sidra. I am 12 years old. I am in the fifth grade. I am from Syria.
Directed by documentarian Chris Milk, it is a breathtaking, altogether immersive experience with a 360-degree view of the surroundings. Grim barracks in a dusty desert, grinding poverty, palpable hopelessness.
11 and 12-year-olds with headscarves on a blacktop playing soccer about next to me.
We have to play football quickly because there are so many kids waiting to play.
And just outside the fences of the blacktop, endless rows of metal barracks. And now I'm in one of those houses.
My mother makes sure we are all together for dinner.
Family of eight, sitting on a rug, eating dinner.
My teacher says the clouds moving over us also came here from Syria. Someday, the clouds and me are going to turn around and go back home.
That's where I got a little choked up. Yet, just as I surrendered to the raw emotion engendered by the virtual proximity, Melcher told me my experience is still rooted in storytelling's past.
That's an incredibly moving piece. But fundamentally, what are we doing? We're sitting watching a film. We're approaching that in the same way that they did when they invented the motion picture camera and they put it on a tripod and they filmed a play. What I'm really interested in, though, is not just the recording, but being able to place somebody in a position where they have the opportunity to have action. And I think you will learn so much more when you're faced with moral dilemmas, when you're faced with making decisions in that space. There's another level of learning that comes from being able to actually be in that experience. That's a really powerful next generation of storytelling.
Like video games or police shoot, don't shoot drills, or for that matter,
Birdly over Manhattan.
So in exactly an analog to my dreams, whoa, I'm about to hit a... Oh, youch. Boom. I just crashed into some skyscraper.
True enough, there is nothing in the physical world that approximates that sensation. And I speak as a man who has twice parasailed drunk. But there is, of course, a comparable playground of the imagination. It's called the imagination, as triggered by, for one thing, reading. And so I confronted Melcher, positing that
the words coming off the printed page still are deeper and richer and, in their way, more experiential than anything that you can feel and see and hear and touch in this Please See, Hear, Touch, and Feel museum.
That's when he compared me to Socrates. Although, you know, not in a good way.
And it's in the Phaedrus where Socrates argues that this newfangled technology of the alphabet and papyrus are undermining our ability to memorize. And without the ability to memorize, we wouldn't know things well enough to be able to discuss them, to be able to debate them. And without that, we would never get to the truth of anything. And so he argued that this was going to be the end of human intelligence.
Okay, so Socrates, if you believe Plato, guessed wrong. And to Melcher's point, it's clear that clinging to the status quo is a losing proposition. Like it or not, future of storytelling-wise, the times, they are a-changin'. And with those changes, perhaps the most impactful journalism ever created, along with, of course, cheap entertainment, demagoguery, propaganda, and certainly porn. After all, pick an age, pick a medium. Isn't that always the story?
Technology can point the way to a future of limitless promise, but man must chart his own course into tomorrow, a course that frees the mind and the spirit as it improves the well-being of mankind.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Kasia Mihailovich, and Sam Dingman. We had more help from Jenna Cagle, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.